The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
So I'm delighted to welcome Adam Liska to today's podcast. Adam's the founder and CEO at Glyphic. They're funded by Point72 Ventures. They've developed an AI co-pilot to make sales teams more productive, improving those conversion rates and increasing revenue. So Adam, welcome to the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
Thanks, Gary. Excited to be here.
Absolutely. So just to kick things off, what inspired you to embark on the Glyphic journey? What were some of the main challenges you encountered in the early stages of building the company?
Definitely. That's a tough question, but it's a direction that I always wanted to go into, to actually build products and build a company. So from that point of view, I knew I was going to do it at one point. It was just a question of when. But actually, specifically in this case, I was very lucky to be a DeepMind working on large language models and kind of research around natural language processing and large language models. So ChatGPT-like models. And being a DeepMind, being a few years ahead of the rest of the world, I really saw where things were going, kind of contributing to this and seeing the potential made me realize that, you know, this technology is going to change everything. That's also where I met my co-founder. And through discussions, eventually we decided to leave DeepMind and start Glyphic, really to kind of bring this technology to the wider market and build a product and iterate fast. An interesting, aside there is, so we left DeepMind 2022. That was pre-ChatGPT, kind of thinking, this is really, we've reached the top hype of artificial intelligence and large language models. And since then, it's just gone to completely new heights. It's just interesting that kind of insider view and outsider view and how these things are not always matched.
What do you think of the hype cycle then? Do you think it's been overhyped over the last few quarters, or do you think things are kind of spot on in terms of the potential of AI and large language models?
I think in terms of the kind of long-term potential of it, I think it's spot on. I think this is really revolutionary technology from that point of view. So I would say spot on, but it's interesting how it takes a while actually for people to realize the potential. And I think for the wider market to understand it as well. I would say what's also interesting in this specific cycle, specifically with large language models, is that looking back, we had similar AI was going through a lot of developments. There were a lot of improvements with systems like AlphaGo, for example, from DeepMind around playing Go, etc. But it was or AlphaFold around protein folding. But these were always applications, I would say, within specific areas that maybe were not so understandable to the wider, population. And taking these technologies and these models to language, which is something that we all very well understand. We use it to store knowledge. We use it to reason. We use it to communicate. Kind of made people realize where AI is. And to be honest, I think it also made researchers realize the potential as well and kind of better understand it. I think even AI researchers didn't expect where we can get and how big of an effect it's going to have on society.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. What are the biggest differences you've experienced at Glyphic versus DeepMind in terms of product development, life cycles, and client engagements?
Yeah, good question. It's actually very, very different just because at DeepMind, I was mostly working on research, a research engineer, so I was in that research part of the company and not in the application part of the company. So I think from that perspective, very different. Instead of working on machine learning models, working on research and publishing research, I'm actually taking that research and that knowledge and putting it into a product and then having actually people who might not understand some of the underlying technology use it in their everyday life. And it's so from that perspective, very different. Also, being in a startup is very different from being in a place like Google. Even if a DeepMind, if I were even in the applied division applying these models to products, it's always very long development cycle, testing cycle, etc. So being in the startup is definitely an advantage. If you want to iterate fast, if you want to be very close with your users, sometimes even, you know, publish or let's say ship things that might not be the way they should, but they're kind of showing the direction and you can get very good feedback from people. Another advantage is AI is moving so fast that you really need to move fast as well with the product and with thinking about the options and the possibilities there. And that's definitely, again, easier when you're in a startup with a smaller customer base where you can actually iterate faster, maybe, you know, deprecate things faster, test things faster with your customers, etc. So very, very different worlds, but both of them very, very exciting.
So how difficult was it for you to adapt to that new cadence of working?
Yeah, it definitely takes time getting used to. So I'm a first-time founder, and so there's a lot to learn. It's not just about, you know, building products, engaging customers, but also how do you build a company? How do you manage all the admin, for example, that's related to that, and operations, and especially hiring is another thing. Kind of hiring without support. I was involved in interviews and hiring a DeepMind, but there you always have a lot of support. Whereas in a startup, it's really just you managing the whole thing. And so there's a lot to learn. It's a kind of every month you feel like you hit the top of intensity that you can manage. And then the next month you get surprised that again, it's even a more intensive job. Another thing here maybe is that as the company grows, you kind of need to also learn to let go of things. That's a learning journey for me as well, where maybe you always, as a founder, you always need to kind of think about the most important, the highest priority things in the startup. And sometimes some of the things that you enjoy and you do well, you can definitely continue doing them, but maybe it's not worth you doing it. You really need to focus on the next thing. And that's sometimes scary as well, because very often you let go of things that you know very well and you need to take up and spend more time doing the things that you don't know or you need to learn. And so that's another difference, I would say, from kind of working in a, let's say, in a position or in a company that I worked before, because this kind of letting go of things and doing new things in a startup just happens much more often.
In the early days, before you had the investors on board, did you have coaches or mentors to help you find the right way of working, to help you understand how to prioritize and work at pace?
We had a good founder network within our friends. And so as soon as we kind of started thinking about potentially, would it make sense for us to start a startup? When we got excited about that, we talked to friends, founders that we had in our network, both in London and abroad. These were very helpful, I think, in our early days, kind of in helping us think about what it even takes to found a company, how to approach fundraising. And then when we actually left DeepMind and kind of started working on this, how do you iterate? How do you talk to customers? How do you pitch? How do you build all that stuff? It was good to have founders that were maybe, let's say, half a year or 1 year ahead of us, because they still remembered all these things that they had to do just a few months ago. And so that kind of advice was very, very useful.
How do things change once the VCs came on board? Obviously, you had more money to spend on hiring, etc. But in what other ways did things change at Glyphic once you had the investors on board?
Yeah, so once you have an investment, you definitely kind of the pace and the focus again needs to increase, because there's kind of clear timelines, clear kind of points that you need to reach in the development of the company. And so, but at the same time, you have again maybe sparring partners with whom you can discuss. And we actually had very good support early on from Point 72 and their operations team around product, around operation. And so we would actually, nearly on a weekly basis, have quick calls whenever, let's say, we were hiring or we were kind of exploring or kind of brainstorming about these specific directions or how to approach them. And so very often we would be discussing with them, because, you know, they see things across their portfolio, they talk to many other founders, and they see trends in the space in general. So it was very, very useful, and kind of another point of view that was very useful, I think, for us in forming the direction and the team as well.
I noticed that you're involved at the recent AI Ignite conference, and one of the topics you explored there was Moore's Law for AI. I've only come across Moore's law in the context of silicon chips and semiconductors. So how does this thesis apply to the world of AI?
It's basically a metaphor around, let's say, the improvements that we're seeing in AI and how things are developing fast. And just like, you know, the number of chips or number of transistors and chips will be increasing, and the computing power of chips was increasing in a similar way, we now see big improvements in AI. And these are both made by chips, but also by us kind of using better models, using better training approaches, training larger models, et cetera. And all these things kind of come together, and especially recently, really accelerate the development and the improvement in AI models. It's an interesting kind of pendulum where we would be actually scaling models, making them much bigger than, you know, previously, ingesting more data to build these very big models. But then once we have these bigger models, we always think of, okay, how can we train a smaller model faster that has just as good performance? So we're kind of always moving, you know, from let's train a big model, let's say inefficient way, but still kind of arriving at a very, very performant model. And then it's a question of how can we do this more efficiently so that we can have smaller models at the same performance. And we're kind of, the development that we're seeing is a bit along kind of a pendulum that kind of keeps on moving. Bigger models, then we kind of scale it down, but we even improve performance, then again, we jump to even bigger models, et cetera. And so we're seeing this performance improvement, and that's supported by both improvements in the modeling data, but also improvements in chips.
So besides the performance improvement and the improvement in data performance and chips, what are the AI trends that you find most fascinating, and how do you anticipate them influencing Lyphic and the evolution of your business over the next few years?
Yeah, so I would say two things, especially this year, that are very interesting is around models being able to ingest more data when they make decisions or when they produce that context length where you can feed, let's say, the whole history of your conversations with a specific company and have the model reason about that when you ask it questions or when you wanted to generate, let's say, a brief or a sales to customer success handover documents and things like that. That's one improvement that's very interesting. And it's going to first make these model perform better, but at the same time, it'll make development of AI-powered products easier because it just makes it much easier for the developers if they can just put all that context into the context of the model and let that model deal with it. So that's one interesting direction that I see, and there's been a lot already since the start of the year, and I'm sure we'll see much more. Another thing is around multimodality. So a lot of the hype in the past couple of years was around language-only models, so AI models that take in text and produce text. And what we see, for example, with the recent Gemini releases from Google, now we have models that can take audio, they can take video, they can produce text, they can produce audio, they can produce video. And I think that's a very interesting development as well, that first of all, opens up new applications in the sense that we can be asking questions over a video. We don't need to kind of transform it into any intermediate representations. But at the same time, it also makes the performance ceiling for the models. It kind of puts it above because suddenly we can train these models not only on all the text that's on the internet, but we can train it on all the YouTube videos that are there, all the podcasts in the native format. And that again, this amount of data is very important for AI training. And the more data we can give these models, the more they perform better and the more they can actually perform operations that we really think seem like reasoning and are kind of intelligent. And so we really want to feed them as much data as possible. And this is an interesting direction that improves new product applications, but also improves the models themselves.
And what's a commonly held belief about AI that you strongly disagree with and why?
A belief about AI that I strongly disagree with. That's an interesting question. One thing that I was always kind of a bit uncertain about is artificial general intelligence and kind of what is it and when do we reach it and how do we define it, etc. I was always not a big fan, I would say, of this term. I was always interested in practical applications of AI, especially around assistive applications. We can definitely automate things, but the assistive augmentation applications are very interesting for me. And so I don't really care when we reach AGI and what it's going to be, but I'm rather interested in making these developments, making sure that people know about these developments and they can kind of realize and think about what it means for the world and for the society. And so I'm, yeah, kind of more focused on that rather than on the AGI, let's say, dream that is a few years, decades ahead of us. I don't know.
Some people regard it as a dream, a pleasant dream, others as a potential nightmare. But you think these debates about AGI and whether it's going to be wonderful or disastrous for mankind, you think they're not so relevant, those kind of philosophical debates?
I find them definitely interesting. It's more like I'm not myself focused on getting to that AGI next year or something like that. I'm really interested in pushing the current models forward and making sure that people use them. But we definitely kind of need to understand the repercussions and kind of the effects that these models will have on the society. But I think in order to actually, for people to realize what the impact of these models is, it's really important for them to be deployed and used in products. And so that's, for example, why I really liked ChatGPT and the wave that happened afterwards. It's just because even though we had these models internally, researchers at top AI labs knew kind of what they were capable of and what they were doing. But I would say most of the population didn't really know what's out there and what AI can really do. And I'm really happy that, for example, ChatGPT made the population aware of where we are and what's possible. And I think that's important because a lot of the discussions that we have now around AI safety and AI regulation, et cetera, we're only having them because ChatGPT was released and people finally realized what the potential is, but also what the potential drawbacks of this technology could be. So I'm always kind of in favor of releasing these models gradually, but kind of as soon as we have them so that people can, population wide, can assess them and learn and understand where the world is moving.
And tell me a bit more about the path you're on as a business. Are you pre-revenue? Have you got live customers? And what's your vision for the business over the next couple of years?
Yeah, definitely. So we started building January last year. And during that year, we built our initial product, shipped it to our design partners, converted our design partners into paying customers. And so we have a live product. We've got revenue. Until now, it was mostly founder-led sales, done by me, my co-founder, and we've got one person on the GTM operations team. But it's actually now that we reach capacity, I would say, in the commercial team and just open a position to hire our founding AE, with whom we kind of want to work on the commercial side, work on our own playbooks, our sales process, how to make it more efficient, and build the foundation so that we can scale the commercial team as well. So exciting times. I think we ship really fast. We evaluated very fast. We know the product's giving value to our existing customers and kind of want to now scale the commercial team and also kind of iterate on the product roadmap that we have. For example, from a founder perspective, very much my focus over the last half year now really moved from product mostly to, I'm still focused on product, but a lot of my time is now taken up by the commercial considerations. Where I would like to get Glyphic is I really want to have a repeatable sales process internally so that we've got that confidence that, you know, we have a product that our customers like, we can prove the value very quickly so that then we can again potentially raise more and scale the company even more. The reason why I want to do it is also AI is moving very fast. And so we need to move fast ourselves as well. And the sales tech space is also moving very fast. And I think it's a very exciting time now where a lot of people are kind of reevaluating the technology they use, the tools they use. So it's just a really good opportunity.
And who are the three technology or business leaders who've inspired you the most?
Also a tough question here. I would say definitely in terms of technology leaders, I would say Demis from DeepMind, definitely, you know, someone that I really, really value and really look up for, kind of his belief in AI, the potential, and kind of being really much ahead of the curve, but at the same time, maintaining the momentum, maintaining the team and really the relevance, I would say, of DeepMind. I think that's great to see. I'm always interested in also builders and people who ship. And from that perspective, to be honest, OpenAI in general, that team, I'm Sam, but also just the whole team. I think that's very interesting because that's kind of what I was always thinking is that we need to actually ship the products for people to use them, as I mentioned earlier. And I think OpenAI have been really good at shipping them, productizing them, getting feedback, and feeding that feedback back into research.
I'll give you more than two because you said it was Sam and the whole team. So I guess you went beyond two people in a way. Cool. Well, it's been interesting hearing about the Glyphic journey and about your journey through DeepMind and into becoming an entrepreneur. I wish you and the team huge success over the coming years. I'll be following your journey closely. So thank you so much for joining me on this week's episode.
Thanks a lot. Really enjoyed it.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.